Welcome to Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Emily of New Moon. Beloved for her iconic role as Miss Stacy in the classic television series Anne of Green Gables, celebrated Canadian actress Marilyn Lightstone now returns to the world of Lucy Maud Montgomery and the magic of Prince Edward Island to bring to life the unforgettable coming-of-age story of the imaginative young heroine Emily Starr. If this is your first time joining us, you can find all episodes of Marilyn Lightstone Reads at classicalfm.ca or on your favorite podcast app. And now, let's turn to Marilyn as she reads Emily of New Moon.
Chapter 8. Trial by Fire. Aunt Elizabeth drove Emily to school the next morning. Aunt Laura had thought that, since there was only a month before vacation, it was not worthwhile for Emily to start school. But Aunt Elizabeth did not yet feel comfortable with the small niece skipping around New Moon, poking into everything insatiably, and was resolved that Emily must go to school to get her out of the way. Emily herself, always avid for new experiences, was quite keen to go, but for all that, she was seething with rebellion as they drove along. Aunt Elizabeth had produced a terrible gingham apron and an equally terrible gingham sunbonnet from somewhere in the New Moon garret and made Emily put them on. The apron was a long sack-like garment high in the neck with sleeves. Those sleeves were the crowning indignity. Emily had never seen any little girl wearing an apron with sleeves. She rebelled to the point of tears over wearing it, but Aunt Elizabeth was not going to have any nonsense. Emily saw the Murray look then, and when she saw it, she buttoned her rebellious feelings tightly up in her soul and let Aunt Elizabeth put the apron on her.
"It was one of your mother's aprons when she was a little girl, Emily," said Aunt Laura, comfortingly and rather sentimentally.
"Then," said Emily, uncomforted and unsentimental, "I don't wonder she ran away with father when she grew up."
Aunt Elizabeth finished buttoning the apron and gave Emily a none too gentle push away from her.
"Put on your sunbonnet," she ordered. "Oh, please, Aunt Elizabeth, don't make me wear that horrid thing."
Aunt Elizabeth, wasting no further words, picked up the bonnet and tied it on Emily's head. Emily had to yield. But from the depths of the sunbonnet issued a voice, defiant though tremulous.
"Anyway, Aunt Elizabeth, you can't boss God," it said.
Aunt Elizabeth was too cross to speak all the way to the schoolhouse. She introduced Emily to Miss Brownell and drove away. School was already in, so Emily hung her sunbonnet on the porch nail and went to the desk Miss Brownell assigned her. She had already made up her mind that she did not like Miss Brownell and never would like her. Miss Brownell had the reputation in Blairwater of being a fine teacher, due mainly to the fact that she was a strict disciplinarian and kept excellent order. She was a thin, middle-aged person, with a colorless face, prominent teeth, most of which she showed when she laughed, and cold, watchful gray eyes, colder even than Aunt Ruth's. Emily felt as if those merciless, agate eyes saw clean through her to the core of her sensitive little soul. Emily could be fearless enough on occasion, but in the presence of a nature which she instinctively felt to be hostile to hers, she shrank away in something that was more repulsion than fear. She was a target for curious glances all the morning. The Blairwater school was large, and there were at least 20 little girls of about her own age. Emily looked back curiously at them all and thought the way they whispered to each other behind hands and books when they looked at her very ill-mannered. She felt suddenly unhappy and homesick and lonesome. She wanted her father and her old home and the dear things she loved.
"The New Moon girl is crying,"
whispered a black-eyed girl across the aisle, and then came a cruel little giggle.
"What is the matter with you, Emily?"
said Miss Brownell, suddenly and accusingly. Emily was silent. She could not tell Miss Brownell what was the matter with her.
especially when Miss Brownell used such a tone. "When I ask one of my pupils a question, Emily, I am accustomed to having an answer. Why are you crying?"
There was another giggle from across the aisle. Emily lifted miserable eyes, and in her extremity fell back on a phrase of her father's.
"It is a matter that concerns only myself," she said.
A red spot suddenly appeared in Miss Brownell's sallow cheek. Her eyes gleamed with cold fire.
"You will remain in during recess as a punishment for your impertinence," she said.
But she left Emily alone the rest of the day. Emily did not in the least mind staying in at recess, for acutely sensitive to her environment as she was, she realized that, for some reason she could not fathom, the atmosphere of the school was antagonistic. The glances cast at her were not only curious, but ill-natured. She did not want to go out to the playground with those girls. She did not want to go to school in Blair Water. But she would not cry any more. She sat erect and kept her eyes on her book. Suddenly, a soft, malignant hiss came across the aisle.
"Miss Pridie! Miss Pridie!"
Emily looked across at the girl. Large, steady, purplish-gray eyes gazed into beady, twinkling black ones, gazed unquailingly, with something in them that cowed and compelled. The black eyes wavered and fell, their owner covering her retreat with another giggle and toss of her short braid of hair.
"I can master her," thought Emily, with a thrill of triumph.
But there is strength in numbers, and at noon hour Emily found herself standing alone on the playground, facing a crowd of unfriendly faces. Children can be the most cruel creatures alive. They have the herd instinct of prejudice against any outsider, and they are merciless in its indulgence. Emily was a stranger, and one of the proud Murrays, 2 counts against her. And there was about her, small and ginghamed and sunbonneted as she was, a certain reserve and dignity and fineness that they resented. And they resented the level way she looked at them, with that disdainful face under cloudy black hair, instead of being shy and drooping as became an interloper on probation.
"You are a proud one," said Black Eyes. "Oh my, you may have buttoned boots, but you are living on charity."
Emily had not wanted to put on the buttoned boots. She wanted to go barefoot as she had always done in summer. But Aunt Elizabeth had told her that no child from New Moon had ever gone barefoot to school.
"Oh, just look at the baby apron,"
laughed another girl with a head of chestnut curls. Now Emily flushed. This was indeed the vulnerable point in her armor. Delighted at her success in drawing blood, the curled one tried again.
"Is that your grandmother's sunbonnet?"
There was a chorus of giggles.
"Oh, she wears a sunbonnet to save her complexion," said a bigger girl. "That's the Murray pride. The Murrays are rotten with pride, my mother says." "You're awfully ugly," said a fat, squat little miss, nearly as broad as she was long. "Your ears look like a cat's." "You needn't be so proud," said Black Eyes. "Your kitchen ceiling isn't plastered even." "And your cousin Jimmy is an idiot," said Chestnut Curls. "He isn't," cried Emily. "He has more sense than any of you. You can say what you like about me, but you are not going to insult my family. If you say one more word about them, I'll look you over with the evil eye."
Nobody understood what this threat meant, but that made it all the more effective. It produced a brief silence. Then the begating began again in a different form.
"Can you sing?"
asked a thin, freckled girl, who yet contrived to be very pretty in spite of thinness and freckles.
"No," said Emily. "Can you dance?" "No." "Can you sew?" "No." "Oh, can you cook?" "No." "Can you knit lace?" "No." "Can you crochet?" "No." "Then what can you do?"
said the freckled one in a contemptuous tone.
"I can write poetry,"
said Emily, without in the least meaning to say it. But at that instant she knew she could write poetry. And with this queer, unreasonable conviction came the flash. Right there, surrounded by hostility and suspicion, fighting alone for her standing, without backing or advantage, came the wonderful moment when soul seemed to cast aside the bonds of flesh and spring upward to the stars. The rapture and delight on Emily's face amazed and enraged her foes. They thought it a manifestation of Murray pride in an uncommon accomplishment.
"You lie," said Black Eyes bluntly. "A star does not lie," retorted Emily.
The flash was gone, but its uplift remained. She looked them all over with a cool detachment that quelled them temporarily.
"Why don't you like me?"
she asked directly. There was no reply. Emily looked straight at Chestnut Curls and repeated her question. Chestnut Curls felt herself compelled to answer it.
Because you ain't a bit like us,"
she muttered.
"I wouldn't want to be,"
said Emily, scornfully.
"Oh, my, you are one of the chosen people,"
mocked Black Eyes.
"Of course I am,"
retorted Emily. She walked away to the schoolhouse, conqueror in that battle. But the forces against her were not so easily cowed. There was much whispering and plotting after she had gone in, a conference with some of the boys, and a handing over of Bedison pencils and chews of gum for value received. An agreeable sense of victory and the afterglow of the flash carried Emily through the afternoon, in spite of the fact that Miss Brownell ridiculed her for her mistakes in spelling. Miss Brownell was very fond of ridiculing her pupils. All the girls in the class giggled, except one who had not been there in the morning and was consequently at the tail. Emily had been wondering who she was. She was as unlike the rest of the girls as Emily herself, but in a totally different style. She was tall, oddly dressed in an overlong dress of faded striped print, and barefooted. Her thick hair, cut short, flushed out all around her head in a bushy wave that seemed to be of brilliant spun gold, and her glowing eyes were of a brown so light and translucent as to be almost amber. Her mouth was large, and she had a saucy, pronounced chin. Pretty she might not be called, but her face was so vivid and mobile that Emily could not drag her fascinated eyes from it. And she was the only girl in class who did not, sometime through the lesson, get a barb of sarcasm from Miss Brownell, though she made as many mistakes as the rest of them. At recess, one of the girls came up to Emily with a box in her hand. Emily knew that she was Rhoda Stewart and thought her very pretty and sweet. Rhoda had been in the crowd around her at the noon hour, but she had not said anything. She was dressed in crispy pink gingham. She had smooth, lustrous braids of sugar-brown hair, big blue eyes, a rosebud mouth, doll-like features, and a sweet voice. If Miss Brownell could be said to have a favorite, it was Rhoda Stewart, and she seemed generally popular in her own set and much petted by the older girls.
"Here is a present for you,"
she said sweetly. Emily took the box unsuspectingly. Rhoda's smile would have disarmed any suspicion. For a moment, Emily was happily anticipant as she removed the cover. Then, with a shriek, she flung the box from her and stood pale and trembling from head to foot. There was a snake in the box. Whether dead or alive, she did not know and did not care. For any snake, Emily had a horror and repulsion she could not overcome. The very sight of one almost paralyzed her. A chorus of giggles ran round the porch.
"Before I'd be so scared of an old dead snake," scoffed Black Eyes. "Can you write poetry about that?"
giggled Chestnut Curls.
"I hate you, I hate you,"
cried Emily,
You are mean, hateful girls.
Calling names isn't ladylike, said the freckled one. I thought a Murray would be too grand for that. If you come to school tomorrow, Miss Star, said Black Eyes deliberately, we are going to take that snake and put it around your neck. Let me see you do it, cried a clear, ringing voice.
Into their midst with a bound came the girl with amber eyes and short hair.
Just let me see you do it, Jenny Strang. This isn't any of your business, Ilsa Burnley, muttered Jenny sullenly. Oh, isn't it? Don't you sass me, piggy eyes.
Ilsa walked up to the retreating Jenny and shook a sunburned fist in her face.
If I catch you teasing Emily Starr tomorrow with that snake again, I'll take it by the tail and you by your tail and slash you across the face with it. Mind that, piggy eyes. Now you go and pick up that precious snake of yours and throw it down on the ash pile.
Jenny actually went and did it. Ilsa faced the others.
Clear out, all of you, and leave the New Moon girl alone after this, she said. If I hear of any more meddling and sneaking, I'll slit your throats and rip out your hearts and tear your eyes out. Yes, and I'll cut off your ears and wear them pinned on my dress.
Cowed by these ferocious threats, or by something in Elsa's personality, Emily's persecutors drifted away. Ilsa turned to Emily.
Don't mind them, she said contemptuously. They're jealous of you, that's all. Jealous because you live at New Moon and ride in a fringe top buggy and wear button boots. You smack their mugs if they give you any more of their jaw.
Ilsa vaulted the fence and tore off into the maple bush without another glance at Emily. Only Rhoda Stewart remained.
Emily, I'm awful sorry, she said, rolling her big blue eyes appealingly. I didn't know there was a snake in that box. Cross my heart, I didn't. The girls just told me it was a present for you. You're not mad, are you? Because I like you.
Emily had been mad and hurt and outraged, but this little bit of friendliness melted her instantly. In a moment, she and Rhoda had their arms around each other, parading across the playground.
I'm going to ask Miss Brownell to let you sit with me, said Rhoda. I used to sit with Annie Gregg, but she's moved away. You'd like to sit with me, wouldn't you?
I'd love it, said Emily warmly. She was as happy as she had been miserable. Here was the friend of her dreams. Already she worshipped Rhoda.
We ought to sit together, said Rhoda importantly. We belong to the two best families in Blearwater. Do you know that if my father had his rights, he would be on the throne of England?
England? Said Emily, too amazed to be anything but an echo.
Yes, we are descended from the kings of Scotland, said Rhoda. So, of course, we don't associate with everybody. My father keeps store, and I'm taking music lessons. Is your Aunt Elizabeth going to give you music lessons?
I don't know. She ought to. Oh, she is very rich, isn't she?
I don't know,
said Emily again. She wished Rhoda would not ask such questions. Emily thought it was hardly good manners. But surely a descendant of the Stuart kings ought to know the rules of breeding, if anybody did.
She's got an awful temper, hasn't she? Asked Rhoda.
No, she hasn't, cried Emily.
Well, she nearly killed your cousin Jimmy in one of her rages, said Rhoda.
That's true. Mother told me. Why doesn't your Aunt Laura get married? Has she got a beau? And what wages does your Aunt Elizabeth pay your cousin Jimmy?
I don't know.
Well, said Rhoda, rather disappointedly, I suppose you haven't been at New Moon long enough to find things out. But it must be very different from what you've been used to, I guess. Your father was as poor as a church mouse, wasn't he?
My father was a very, very rich man, said Emily deliberately.
Rhoda stared.
I thought he hadn't a cent.
Neither he had. But people can be rich without money.
Well, I don't see how. But anyhow, you'll be rich some day. Your Aunt Elizabeth will likely leave you all her money. Mother says so. So I don't care if you are living on charity. I love you, and I'm going to stick up for you. Have you got a beau, Emily?"
"No," cried Emily, blushing violently and quite scandalized at the idea.
"Why, I'm only 11. Oh, everybody in our class has a beau. Mine is Teddy Kent. I shook hands with him after I'd counted 9 stars for 9 nights without missing a night. If you do that, the first boy you shake hands with afterwards is to be your beau. But it's awful hard to do. It took me all winter. Teddy wasn't in school today. He's been sick all June. He's the best-looking boy in Blairwater."
"Well, you'll have to have a beau too, Emily."
"I won't,"
declared Emily angrily.
"I don't know a thing about beaus, and I won't have one."
Rhoda tossed her head.
"Oh, I suppose you think there's nobody good enough for you, living in New Moon. Well, you won't be able to play clap in and clap out if you haven't a beau."
Emily knew nothing of the mysteries of clap in and clap out and didn't care. Anyway, she wasn't going to have a beau, and she repeated this in such decided tones that Rhoda deemed it wise to drop the subject. Emily was rather glad when the bell rang. Miss Brownell granted Rhoda's request quite graciously, and Emily transferred her goods and chattels to Rhoda's seat. Rhoda whispered a good deal during the last hour, and Emily got scolded for it, but did not mind.
"I'm going to have a birthday party the first week in July, and I'm going to invite you, if your aunts will let you come. I'm not going to have Ilsa Burnley, though." "Don't you like her?" "Oh, no, she's an awful tomboy. And then her father is an infidel. And so's she. She always spells God with a little G in her dictation. Miss Brownell scolds her for it, but she does it right along. Miss Brownell won't whip her because she's setting her cap for Dr. Burnley. But Ma says she won't get him because he hates women. I don't think it's proper to associate with such people. Ilsa is an awful wild, queer girl and has an awful temper, and so is her father. She doesn't chum with anybody. Isn't it ridiculous the way she wears her hair? You ought to have a bang, Emily. They're all the rage, and you'd look well with one because you've such a high forehead. It would make a real beauty of you. Oh, my, but you have lovely hair, and your hands are just lovely. All the Murrays have pretty hands, and you have the sweetest eyes, Emily."
Emily had never received so many compliments in her life. Rhoda laid flattery on with a trowel. Her head was quite turned, and she went home from school determined to ask Aunt Elizabeth to cut her hair in a bang. If it would make a beauty of her, it must be compassed somehow. And she would also ask Aunt Elizabeth if she might wear her Venetian beads to school next day.
"The other girls may respect me more then," she thought.
She was alone from the crossroads where she had parted company with Rhoda, and she reviewed the events of the day with a feeling that, after all, she had kept the star flag flying, except for a temporary reverse in the matter of the stake. School was very different from what she had expected it to be. But that was the way in life, she had heard Ellen Green say, and you had just to make the best of it. Rhoda was a darling, and there was something about Ilsa Burnley that one liked. And as for the rest of the girls, Emily got square with them by pretending she saw them all being hanged in a row for frightening her to death with a snake, and felt no more resentment towards them, although some of the things that had been said to her rankled bitterly in her heart for many a day. She had no father to tell them to, and no account book to write them out in, so she could not exercise them. She had no speedy chance to ask for a bang, for there was company at New Moon, and her aunts were busy getting ready an elaborate supper. But when the preserves were brought on, Emily snatched the opportunity of a lull in the older conversation.
"Aunt Elizabeth," she said, "can I have a bang?"
Aunt Elizabeth looked her disdain. "No," she said, "I do not approve of bangs. Of all the silly fashions that have come in nowadays, bangs are the silliest."
"Oh, Aunt Elizabeth, do let me have a bang.
It would make a beauty of me. Rhoda says so.
It would take a good deal more than a bang to do that, Emily. We will not have bangs at New Moon, except on the Molly Cows. They are the only creatures that should wear bangs.
Aunt Elizabeth smiled triumphantly around the table. Aunt Elizabeth did smile sometimes when she thought she had silenced some small person by exquisite ridicule. Emily understood that it was no use to hope for bangs. Loveliness did not lie that way for her.
It was mean of Aunt Elizabeth. Mean!
She heaved a sigh of disappointment and dismissed the idea for the present. There was something else she wanted to know.
"Why doesn't Ilse Burnley's father believe in God?" she asked.
"'Cause of the trick her mother played him," said Mr. Slade, with a chuckle. Mr. Slade was a fat, jolly-looking old man with bushy hair and whiskers. He had already said some things Emily could not understand, and which had seemed greatly to embarrass his very ladylike wife.
"What trick did Ilse's mother play?"
asked Emily, all agog with interest. Now Aunt Laura looked at Aunt Elizabeth, and Aunt Elizabeth looked at Aunt Laura. Then the latter said,
"Run out and feed the chickens, Emily."
Emily rose with dignity.
"You might just as well tell me that Ilse's mother isn't to be talked about, and I would obey you. I understand perfectly what you mean,"
she said, as she left the table. Chapter 9 A Special Providence. Emily was sure on that first day at school that she would never like it. She must go, she knew, in order to get an education and be ready to earn her own living. But it would always be what Ellen Green solemnly called a cross. Consequently, Emily felt quite astonished when, after going to school a few days, it dawned upon her that she was liking it. To be sure, Miss Brownell did not improve on acquaintance, but the other girls no longer tormented her. Indeed, to her amazement, they seemed suddenly to forget all that had happened and hailed her as one of themselves. She was admitted to the fellowship of the pack, and although in some occasional tiff she got a dig about baby aprons and Murray pride, there was no more hostility, veiled or open. Besides, Emily was quite able to give digs herself, as she learned more about the girls and their weak points, and she could give them with such merciless lucidity and irony that the others soon learned not to provoke them. Chestnut Curls, whose name was Grace Wells, and the freckled one, whose name was Carrie King, and Jenny Strang became quite chummy with her, and Jenny sent chews of gum and tissue thumb papers across the aisle instead of giggles. Emily allowed them all to enter the outer court of her temple of friendship, but only Rhoda was admitted to the inner shrine. As for Ilse Burnley, she did not appear after that first day. Ilse, so Rhoda said, came to school or not, just as she liked. Her father never bothered about her. Emily also felt a certain hankering to know more of Ilse, but it did not seem likely to be gratified. Emily was insensibly becoming happy again. Already she felt as if she belonged to this old cradle of her family. She thought a great deal about the old Murrays. She liked to picture them revisiting the glimpses of New Moon. Great-grandmother rubbing up her candlesticks and making cheeses. Great-aunt Miriam stealing about looking for her lost treasure. Homesick great-great-aunt Elizabeth stalking about in her bonnet. Captain George, the dashing bronze sea captain, coming home with the spotted shells of the Indies. Stephen, the beloved of all, smiling from its windows. Her own mother, dreaming of father. They all seemed as real to her as if she had known them in life. She still had terrible hours when she was overwhelmed by grief for her father, and when all the splendors of New Moon could not stifle the longing for the shabby little house in the hollow where they had loved each other so. Then Emily fled to some secret corner and cried her heart out,
emerging with red eyes that always seemed to annoy Aunt Elizabeth. Aunt Elizabeth had become used to having Emily at New Moon, but she had not drawn any nearer to the child. This hurt Emily always, but Aunt Laura and Cousin Jimmy loved her, and she had Saucy Sal and Rhoda. Fields creamy with clover, soft dark trees against amber skies, and the madcap music the Wind Woman made in the firs behind the barns when she blew straight up from the gulf. Her days became vivid and interesting, full of little pleasures and delights, like tiny opening golden buds on the tree of life. If she could only have had her old yellow account book, or some equivalent, she could have been fully content. She missed it next to her father, and its enforced burning was something for which he held Aunt Elizabeth responsible, and for which he felt she could never wholly forgive her. It did not seem possible to get any substitute. As Cousin Jimmy had said, writing paper of any kind was scarce at New Moon. Letters were seldom written, and when they were, a sheet of notepaper sufficed. Emily dared not ask Aunt Elizabeth for any. There were times when she felt she would burst if she couldn't write out some of the things that came to her. She found a certain safety valve in writing on her slate in school, but these scribblings had to be rubbed off sooner or later, which left Emily with a sense of loss. And there was always the danger that Miss Brownell would see them. That, Emily felt, would be unendurable. No stranger eyes must behold these sacred productions. Sometimes she let Rhoda read them, though Rhoda rasped her by giggling over her finest flights. Emily thought Rhoda as near perfection as a human being could be, but giggling was her fault. But there is a destiny which shapes the ends of young misses who are born with the itch for writing tingling in their baby fingertips. And in the fullness of time, this destiny gave to Emily the desire of her heart. Gave it to her, too, on the very day when she most needed it. That was the day, the ill-starred day, when Miss Brownell elected to show the fifth class, by example as well as precept, how the bugle song should be read. Standing on the platform, Miss Brownell, who was not devoid of a superficial elocutionary knack, read those three wonderful verses. Emily, who should have been doing a sum in long division, dropped her pencil and listened, entranced. She had never heard the bugle song before, but now she heard it and saw it, the rose-red splendor falling on those storied snowy summits and ruined castles, the lights that never were on land or sea, streaming over the lakes. She heard the wild echoes flying through the purple valleys and the misty passes. The mere sound of the words seemed to make an exquisite echo in her soul. And when Miss Brownell came to "Horns of Elfland, faintly blowing," Emily trembled with delight. She was snatched out of herself. She forgot everything but the magic of that unequaled line. She sprang from her seat, knocking her slate to the floor with a clatter. She rushed up the aisle. She caught Miss Brownell's arm. "Oh, teacher," she cried with passionate earnestness, "read that line over again. Oh, read that line over again." Miss Brownell, thus suddenly halted in her elocutionary display, looked down into a rapt, uplifted face where great purplish-gray eyes were shining with the radiance of a divine vision. And Miss Brownell was angry. Angry with this breach of her strict discipline. Angry with this unseemly display of interest in a third-class atom whose attention should have been focused on long division. Miss Brownell shut her book and shut her lips and gave Emily a resounding slap on her face. "Go back to your seat and mind your own business, Emily Starr," said Miss Brownell, her cold eyes malignant with her fury. Emily, thus dashed to earth, moved back to her seat in a daze. Her smitten cheek was crimson, But the wound was in her heart. One moment ago, in the seventh heaven, and now this. Pain, humiliation, misunderstanding. She could not bear it. What had she done to deserve it? She had never been slapped in her life before. The degradation and the injustice ate into her soul. She could not cry. This was a grief too deep for tears. She went home from school in a suppressed anguish of bitterness and shame and resentment, an anguish that had no outlet, for she dared not tell her story at New Moon. Aunt Elizabeth, she felt sure, would say that Miss Brownell had done quite right, and even Aunt Laura, kind and sweet as she was, would not understand. She would be grieved because Emily had misbehaved in school and had had to be punished. Oh, if I could only tell Father all about it, thought Emily. She could not eat any supper. She did not think she would ever be able to eat again. And oh, how she hated that unjust, horrid Miss Brownell. She could never forgive her, never. If there were only some way in which she could get square with Miss Brownell. Emily, sitting small and pale and quiet at the New Moon supper table, was a seething volcano of wounded feelings and misery and pride. Aye, pride! Worse even than the injustice was the sting of humiliation over this thing that had happened. She, Emily Bird Starr, on whom no hand had ever before been ungently laid, had been slapped like a naughty baby before the whole school. Who could endure this and live? Then Destiny stepped in and drew Aunt Laura to the sitting-room bookcase to look in its lower compartment for a certain letter she wanted to see. She took Emily with her to show her a curious old snuff-box that had belonged to Hugh Murray, and in rummaging for it, lifted out a big flat bundle of dusty paper, paper of a deep pink color in oddly long and narrow sheets. "It's time these old letter bills were burned," she said. "Oh, what a pile of them! They've been here gathering dust for years, and they are no earthly good. Father once kept the post office here at New Moon, you know, Emily. The mail came only 3 times a week then, and each day there was one of these long red letter bills, as they were called. Mother always kept them, though when once used they were of no further use. But I'm going to burn them right away." "Oh, Aunt Laura," gasped Emily, so torn between desire and fear that she could hardly speak. "Oh, don't do that. Give them to me. Please, please give them to me." "Why, child, whatever do you want of them?" Oh, Auntie, they have such lovely blank backs for writing on. Oh, please, please, Aunt Laura, it would be a sin to burn those letter bills." "You can have them, dear, only you'd better not let Elizabeth see them." I won't, breathed Emily. She gathered her precious booty into her arms and fairly ran upstairs, and then upstairs again into the garret, where she already had her favorite haunt, in which her uncomfortable habit of thinking of things thousands of miles away could not vex Aunt Elizabeth. This was the quiet corner of the dormer window, where shadows always moved about, softly and swingingly, and beautiful mosaics patterned the bare floor. From it one could see over the treetops, right down to the Blair Water. The walls were hung around with great bundles of soft, fluffy rolls, all ready for spinning, and hanks of untwisted yarn. Sometimes Aunt Laura spun on the great wheel at the other end of the garret, and Emily loved the whirr of it. In the recess of the dormer window, she crouched. Breathlessly, she selected a letter bill and extracted a lead pencil from her pocket. An old sheet of cardboard served as a desk. She began to write feverishly. "Dear Father," and then she poured out her tale of the day, of her rapture and her pain, writing heedlessly and intently until the sunset faded into dim, star-litten twilight. The chickens went unfed. Cousin Jimmy had to go himself for the cows. Saucy Sal got no new milk. And Laura had to wash the dishes. But what mattered it? Emily, in the delightful throes of literary composition, was lost to all worldly things. When she had covered the backs of four letter bills, she could see to write no more. But she had emptied out her soul, and it was once more free from evil passions. She even felt curiously indifferent to Miss Brownell. Emily folded up her letter bills and wrote clearly across the packet, "Mr. Douglas Starr, on the road to heaven." Then she stepped softly across to an old worn-out sofa in a far corner and knelt down, stowing away her letter and her letter bills snugly on a little shelf formed by a board nailed across it underneath. Emily had discovered this one day when playing in the garret and had noted it as a lovely hiding place for secret documents. Nobody would ever come across them there. She had writing paper enough to last for months. There must be hundreds of those jolly old letter bills. "Oh," cried Emily, dancing down the garret stairs, "I feel as if I was made out of stardust." Thereafter, few evenings passed on which Emily did not steal up to the garret and write a letter, long or short, to her father. The bitterness died out of her grief. Writing to him seemed to bring him so near, and she told him everything, with a certain honesty of confession that was characteristic of her. Her triumphs, her failures, her joys, her sorrows, everything went down on the letter bills of a government which had not been so economical of paper as it afterwards became. There was fully half a yard of paper in each bill, and Emily wrote a small hand and made the most of every inch. "I like New Moon. It's so stately and splendid here," she told her father. "And it seems as if we must be very aristocratic when we have a sundial. I can't help feeling proud of it all. I am afraid I have too much pride, and so I ask God every night to take most of it away, but not quite all. It is very easy to get a reputation for pride in Blairwater School. If you walk straight and hold your head up, you are a proud one. Rhoda is proud, too, because her father ought to be King of England. I wonder how Queen Victoria would feel if she knew that. It's very wonderful to have a friend who would be a princess if everyone had their rights. I love Rhoda with all my heart. She is so sweet and kind, but I don't like her giggles. And when I told her I could see the school wallpaper small in the air, she said, 'You lie.' It hurt me awfully to have my dearest friend say that to me, and it hurt me worse when I woke up in the night and thought about it. I had to stay awake ever so long, too, because I was tired lying on one side, and I was afraid to turn over because Aunt Elizabeth would think I was fidgeting. I didn't dare tell Rhoda about the Wind Woman, because I suppose that really is a kind of lie, although she seems so real to me. I hear her now, singing up on the roof around the big chimneys. I have no Emily in the glass here. The looking glasses are all too high up in the rooms I've been in. I've never been in the lookout. It is always locked. It was Mother's room, and Cousin Jimmy says her father locked it up after she ran away with you, and Aunt Elizabeth keeps it locked still out of respect to his memory, though Cousin Jimmy says Aunt Elizabeth used to fight with her father something scandalous when he was alive, though no outsider knew of it because of the Murray pride. I feel that way myself. When Rhoda asked me if Aunt Elizabeth burned candles because she was old-fashioned, I answered haughtily, 'No, it was a Murray tradition. Cousin Jimmy has told me all the traditions of the Murrays. Saucy Sal is very well and bosses the barns, but still she will not have kittens, and I can't understand it. I asked Aunt Elizabeth about it, and she said nice little girls didn't talk about such things, but I cannot see why kittens are improper.
When Aunt Elizabeth is away, Aunt Laura and I smuggle Sal into the house. But when Aunt Elizabeth comes back, I always feel guilty and wish I hadn't. But the next time, I do it again. I think that's very strange. I never hear about dear Mike. I wrote Ellen Green and asked about him, and she replied and never mentioned Mike, but told me all about her rheumatism, as if I cared about her rheumatism. Rhoda is going to have a birthday party, and she is going to invite me. I am so excited. You know, I never was to a party before. I think about it a great deal and picture it out. Rhoda is not going to invite all the girls, but only a favored few. I hope Aunt Elizabeth will let me wear my white dress and good hat. Oh, Father, I pinned that lovely picture of the lace ball dress up on the wall of Aunt Elizabeth's room, just like I had it at home, and Aunt Elizabeth took it down and burned it and scolded me for making pin marks in the paper. I said, Aunt Elizabeth, you should not have burned that picture. I wanted to have it when I grow up, to have a dress made like it for balls. And Aunt Elizabeth said, do you expect to attend many balls, if I may ask? And I said, yes, when I am rich and famous. And Aunt Elizabeth said, yes, when the moon is made of green cheese. I saw Dr. Burnley yesterday when he came over to buy some eggs from Aunt Elizabeth. I was disappointed because he looks just like other people. I thought a man who didn't believe in God would look queer in some way. He did not swear either, and I was sorry, for I have never heard anyone swear, and I am very anxious to. He has big yellow eyes like Ilsa, and a loud voice, and Rhoda says when he gets mad, you can hear him yelling all over Blair Water. There is some mystery about Ilsa's mother which I cannot fathom. Dr. Burnley and Ilsa live alone. Rhoda says Dr. Burnley says he will have no devils of women in that house. That speech is wicked, but striking. Old Mrs. Sims goes over and cooks dinner and supper for them, and then vamooses, and they get their own breakfast. The doctor sweeps out of the house now and then, and Ilsa never does anything but run wild. The doctor never smiles, so Rhoda says. He must be like King Henry II. I would like to get acquainted with Ilsa. She isn't as sweet as Rhoda, but I like her looks too. But she doesn't come to school much, and Rhoda says I mustn't have any chum but her, or she will cry her eyes out. Rhoda loves me as much as I love her. We are both going to pray that we may live together all our lives and die the same day. Aunt Elizabeth always puts up my school dinner for me. She won't give me anything but plain bread and butter, but she cuts good thick slices, and the butter is thick too, and never has the horrid taste Ellen Green's butter used to have. And Aunt Laura slips in a cookie or an apple turnover when Aunt Elizabeth's back is turned. Aunt Elizabeth says apple turnovers are not healthy for me. Why is it that the nicest things are never healthy, Father? Ellen Green used to say that too. My teacher's name is Miss Brownell. I don't like the cut of her jib. That is a nautical phrase that Cousin Jimmy uses. I know phrase is not spelt right, but there is no dictionary at New Moon, but that is the sound of it. She is too sarcastic, and she likes to make you ridiculous. Then she laughs at you in a disagreeable, snorting way. But I forgave her for slapping me, and I took a bouquet to her to school the next day to make up. She received it very coldly and let it fade on her desk. In a story, she would have wept on my neck. I don't know whether it is any use forgiving people or not. Yes, it is. It makes you feel more comfortable yourself. You never had to wear baby aprons and sunbonnets because you were a boy, so you can't understand how I feel about it. And the aprons are made of such good stuff that they will never wear out, and it will be years before I grow out of them. But I have a white dress for church with a black silk sash, and a white leghorn hat with black bows, and black kid slippers, and I feel very elegant in them.
I wish I could have a bang, but Aunt Elizabeth will not hear of it. Rhoda told me I had beautiful eyes. I wish she hadn't. I have always suspected my eyes were beautiful, but I was not sure. Now that I know they are, I'm afraid I'll always be wondering if people notice it. I have to go to bed at 8:30, and I don't like it. But I sit up in bed and look out of the window till it gets dark. So I get square with Aunt Elizabeth that way, and I listen to the sound the sea makes. I like it now, though it always makes me feel sorrowful. But it's a kind of nice sorrow. I have to sleep with Aunt Elizabeth, and I don't like that either, because if I move ever so little, she says I fidget. But she admits that I don't kick, and she won't let me put the window up. She doesn't like fresh air or light in the house. The parlor is dark as a tomb. I went in one day and rolled up all the blinds, and Aunt Elizabeth was horrified and called me a little hussy and gave me the Murray look. You would suppose I had committed a crime. I felt so insulted that I came up to the garret and wrote a description of myself being drowned on a letter bill, and then I felt better. Aunt Elizabeth said I was never to go into the parlor again without permission, but I don't want to. I'm afraid of the parlor. All the walls are hung over with pictures of our ancestors, and there is not one good-looking person among them except Grandfather Murray, who looks handsome, but very cross. The spare room is upstairs and is just as gloomy as the parlor. Aunt Elizabeth only lets distinguished people sleep there. I like the kitchen in daytime, and the garret, and the cookhouse, and the sitting room, and the hall, because of the lovely red front door. And I love the dairy. But I don't like the other new moon rooms. Oh, I forgot the cellar cupboard. I love to go down there and look at the beautiful rows of jam and jelly pots. Cousin Jimmy says it is a new moon tradition that the jam pots must never be empty. What a lot of traditions New Moon has! It is a very spacious house, and the trees are lovely. I have named the three Lombardies at the garden gate the three princesses, and I have named the old summer house Emily's Bower, and the big apple tree by the old orchard gate the praying tree, because it holds up its long boughs exactly as Mr. Dare holds up his arms in church when he prays. Aunt Elizabeth has given me the little right-hand top bureau drawer to keep my things in. Oh, Father dear, I have made a great discovery. I wish I had made it when you were alive, for I think you'd have liked to know. I can write poetry. Perhaps I could have written it long ago if I'd tried. But after that first day in school, I felt I was bound in honor to try, and it is so easy. There is a little curly black-covered book in Aunt Elizabeth's bookcase called Thomson's Seasons, and I decided I would write a poem on a season, and the first three lines are, "Now autumn comes, ripe with the peach and pear. The sportsman's horn is heard throughout the land, and the poor partridge, fluttering, falls dead." Of course, there are no peaches in Prince Edward Island, and I never heard a sportsman's horn here either, but you don't have to stick too close to facts in poetry. I filled a whole letter bill with it, and then I ran and read it to Aunt Laura. I thought she would be overjoyed to find she had a niece who could write poetry, but she took it very coolly and said it didn't sound much like poetry. "It's blank verse," I cried. "Very blank," said Aunt Elizabeth sarcastically, though I hadn't asked her opinion. "But I think I will write rhyming poetry after this, so there will be no mistake about it. And I intend to be a poetess when I grow up and become famous. I hope also that I will be sylph-like. A poetess should be sylph-like. Cousin Jimmy makes poetry, too. He has made over 1,000 pieces, but he never writes any down, but carries them in his head. I offered to give him some of my letter bills, for he is very kind to me, but he said he was too old to learn new habits.
I haven't heard any of his poetry yet, because the spirit hasn't moved him. But I'm very anxious to, and I'm sorry they don't fatten the pigs till the fall.
I like Cousin Jimmy more and more all the time, except when he takes his queer spells of looking and talking. Then he frightens me. But they never last long.
I have read a good many of the books in the New Moon bookcase. A history of the Reformation in France, very religious and sad. A little fat book describing the months in England and the aforesaid Thomson's Seasons. I like to read them because they have so many pretty words in them, but I don't like the feel of them. The paper is so rough and thick it makes me creepy. Travels in Spain. Very fascinating, with lovely, smooth, shiny paper. A missionary book on the Pacific Islands. Pictures very interesting because of the way the heathen chiefs arrange their hair. After they became Christians, they cut it off, which I think was a pity. Mrs. Hammond's poems. I am passionately fond of poetry, also of stories about desert islands. Rob Roy, a novel. But I only read a little of it when Aunt Elizabeth said I must stop because I must not read novels. Aunt Laura says to read it on the sly. I don't see why it shouldn't be all right to obey Aunt Laura, but I have a queer feeling about it, and I haven't yet. A lovely tiger book, full of pictures and stories of tigers that make me feel so nice and shivery. The Royal Road, also religious, but some fun in it, so very good for Sundays. Reuben and Grace, a story, but not a novel, because Reuben and Grace are brother and sister, and there is no getting married. Little Katie and Jolly Jim, same as above, but not so exciting and tragic. Nature's Mighty Wonders, which is good and improving. Alice in Wonderland, which is perfectly lovely. And the memoirs of Ansonetta B. Peters, who was converted at 7 and died at 12. When anybody asked for a question, she answered with a hymn verse. That is after she was converted. Before that, she spoke English. Aunt Elizabeth told me I ought to try to be like Ansonetta. I think I might be an Alice under more favorable circumstances, but I am sure I can never be as good as Ansonetta was, and I don't believe I want to be because she never had any fun. She got sick as soon as she was converted and suffered agonies for years. Besides, I am sure that if I talked hymns to people, it would excite ridicule. I tried it once. Aunt Laura asked me the other day if I would like blue stripes better than red in my next winter stockings, and I answered just as Ansonetta did when asked a similar question, only different, about a sack. Jesus, thy blood and righteousness, my beauty are, my glorious dress. And Aunt Laura said, was I crazy? And Aunt Elizabeth said, I was irreverent. So I know it wouldn't work. Besides, Ansonetta couldn't eat anything for years, having ulcers in her stomach, and I am pretty fond of good eating. Old Mr. Wales on the Dairy Pond Road is dying of cancer. Denny Strang says his wife has her mourning all ready. I wrote a biography of Saucy Sal today, and a description of the road in Lofty John's Bush. I will pin them to this letter so you can read them too. Good night, my beloved father. Your most obedient, humble servant, Emily B. Starr. P.S. I think Aunt Laura loves me. I like to be loved, father dear. E.B.S.
Thank you for listening to Marilyn Lightstone Reads, part of the Zoomer Podcast Network. This episode was produced by Duncan Briggs, executive producer Moses Neimer. Discover more of Marilyn's readings, including Pride and Prejudice, Sense and Sensibility, Vanity Fair, Jane Eyre, and Anne of Green Gables at classicalfm.ca or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also support this series by recommending it to your friends and leaving a 5-star review. Marilyn Lightstone Reads, beautiful stories, beautifully read for a crazy world.